listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the February 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. The fog of war. How can we trust the images we see from the Israel-Hamas conflict? By Fred Richin. Opening photo, a Tel Aviv installation in November displays images of hostages abducted by Hamas. For those of us on the outside, the fog of war is beginning to resemble a total eclipse of the sun. With the contraction of print publications, the front pages of newspapers, and the covers of news magazines have essentially disappeared, no longer providing a unifying focus. With a multitude of factions weaponizing media, using fake or misleading imagery in a parallel media war, viewers have been left largely in the dark, not knowing with whom to empathize, their tribal loyalties reinforced. And now, with mounting skepticism, fueled by such manipulations, the photographs and videos that actually depict the conflict between Hamas and Israel are increasingly considered suspect. As a result, the BBC can publish an article on how 2 4-year-old boys, Omer and Omar, one Israeli and one Palestinian, were both killed in the early days of the war, their deaths exploited in a social media battle. Some have argued that it is not Omar who has been depicted, but a doll. Others, that Omer and his sisters did not die, but are crisis actors. Omar's mother, who confirmed to the BBC that her son had been killed by an airstrike, has been forced to protect her child's memory from this grotesque accusation. They have no right to say he is a doll. A friend of Omer's family, all 5 of whom were reportedly massacred, told the BBC, "To deal with their death is hard enough, and all these comments make it even worse." Previously, the photographs of children brutalized by adults became icons that served as pleas for the violence to stop. Such was the case with the horrific images of 14-year-old Emmett Till, a black child beaten and lynched in 1955 by racists in Mississippi. When his mother allowed pictures of young Emmett's body to be shared with the press, public reaction helped spark the civil rights movement. Viewers responded with outrage as well to the photo of 9-year-old Kim Phuc Phan Thi, her body burning from napalm, dropped by a South Vietnamese plane in 1972, of Hector Peterson, aged 12, killed in 1976 by South African police in a peaceful protest during the apartheid era, and of Alan Kurdi, age 3, lying face down on the beach, having drowned as his family tried to escape from Syria in 2015. There was empathy for these children, their tragic fates mourned, not belittled or dismissed. Today, while many people who post imagery on social media are credible and responsible, providing insider perspectives and expert insights, there are also legions of rogue online fabricators. Now, as Vaibhav Vats reports from India for The Atlantic, a grim video of a beheading by a Mexican drug cartel was shared as an attack on Israeli citizens. A 2014 video of the Islamic State destroying a mosque in Syria was labeled as the Israeli bombing of a Palestinian mosque. Why? Vats explains, the disinformation machinery of the Hindu right has been operating in an amoral zone, treating the Israel-Hamas war as little more than an entertaining spectacle happening somewhere far away, and as a windfall for its Islamophobic agenda. The recent emergence of AI-generated media runs the risk of making people wary even of genuine imagery. as Hani Farid, a UC Berkeley specialist in disinformation, told the New York Times, the specter of deep fakes is much, much more significant now. It just takes a few, and then you poison the well, and everything becomes suspect. People then accuse media outlets and those in power, the article suggests, of brazenly trying to manipulate public opinion by creating AI content, even when the content is almost certainly genuine. Or such fabrications can be used for things that should have happened but did not. The Instagram account Happy Children of Palestine is intended as a commentary on the difficulties many Palestinian children endure. By creating synthetic images of non-existent children smiling and laughing in a bakery, drinking water, or playing on a playground. The account argues that this artwork, though born from artificial intelligence, reflects a harsh truth. A reminder that without peace, the playgrounds lie silent, the swings unmoving, and the hopeful eyes of the young are forced to witness scenes of a script written by the hands of conflict and adversity. Next photo, at a Ramallah West Bank rally in support of Gaza in November, people hold photos of Palestinians in Israeli jails. In this chaos of images, it is more and more difficult for the documentation of actual events by professional visual journalists to emerge and be trusted. Often, photojournalists and videographers are thrown into conflicts without the ability to explore their context and ramifications. And chronicling the conflict comes with a heavy toll. In the first month of the war between Hamas and Israel, 39 journalists and media workers were killed, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. As representatives of the foreign press, such correspondents provide coverage that may also be judged by insiders as incomplete and biased, as well as criticized by outsiders as insufficiently supportive of their own preconceptions. The public square of ideas to which these visual journalists used to powerfully contribute now lies largely dormant. Part of the problem is that until breaking news erupts, many regions of the world are left unexamined. For decades, little attempt has been made, for example, to understand the daily lives of Palestinians in Gaza outside of the outbreaks of violence. Who are the teachers, the doctors, the poets, the parents, and the children who live there? What are their hopes and dreams? Without such background, all Gazans can be perceived as monochromatic, synonymous with Hamas, making false, invented narratives easier to foist on a public who have had little with which to compare them. Similarly, why have the ambitions of Jewish settlers on the West Bank been allowed to dominate the news over the years, while the work of Israeli peace activists, including some who were casualties of the initial Hamas onslaught, been left almost entirely unexplored? Are their goals any less valid? Widely published photo essays in the heyday of picture magazines used to help transcend such reactive coverage by offering nuance and complexity. Without such context, conflicts end up looking like incomprehensible variations of one another, spectacles of violence and destruction. What can be done to restore a sense of the actual? Organizations are now working on systems to watermark images or to establish where and when they were first made and whether they were digitally modified. None of these systems are likely to be foolproof, nor will they somehow miraculously restore the trust of viewers. According to a recent Knight Foundation and Gallup survey, half of Americans already believe that most national news organizations intend to mislead, misinform, or persuade the public. But one partial solution involves regarding photographers in a manner similar to how writers are viewed, as authors responsible for the integrity of their own work. As the former picture editor of the New York Times Magazine and a longtime champion of the authenticity of visual reportage, I have been involved in an effort, along with representatives of organizations including World Press Photo, Magnum Photos, and the National Press Photographers Association, to try to reclaim photojournalism's original mission. In response to the abundance of manipulated and synthetic images online, we recently launched a website, Writing with Light, and our statement of principles begins, "As recordings of the visible, journalistic photographs must be fair and accurate representations of what the photographer witnessed." While our initiative will not suddenly illuminate the fog, it may provide some coherence and needed light. Even so, as I finish writing this, 50 years to the day that I began my first job in media, I am still left feeling aghast. Pretty Boys. This Oscar season has redefined the himbo by Rebecca Ford, with the opening illustration by Pamela Wang, showing various stars, male leads, in current movies. Amateur etymologists, or professional ones who've run out of fancier words to dig into, may be interested to learn that the noun himbo entered the English language 36 years ago, thanks to Rita Kempley of the Washington Post. Their chest measurements rival Dolly Parton's, she wrote. Their brains would embarrass a squid. They do nude scenes and are wildly popular with both girls and boys. They come in two varieties, greased and armed to the teeth, or moosed and undressed to die for. The former category included Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger, the latter Richard Gere, Tom Selleck, and, remember, this was the 80s, Gary Hart. In the years since, himbos have thrived and proliferated. That's partly because while the word bimbo is universally understood to be pejorative, men can generally find a way to take anything as a compliment. In fairness, later waves of himbos have more going on for them than their forebears did, including endearing qualities that transformed them, despite their flaws, into one of the more likable male archetypes out there. Think about how dear to our hearts the following non-deep thinkers are. The lovable Smoothie Joey from Friends, the molten stripper known as Magic Mike, even Thor from the Marvel movies with his biceps and hammer. There's so little stigma attached to playing a dim or dim-adjacent male character that some of our most resourceful actors have recently done variations on the theme, and there are now himbos in the Oscar race. The most gloriously unreconstituted new member of the species, of course, is Ryan Gosling's gorgeous bleach-blonde Ken and Greta Gerwig's sly smash Barbie. Ken must have felt the old gym tan laundry way of life from the Jersey Shore sounded like too much of a headache, because his job is famously just beach. Gosling has displayed all kinds of range as an actor in the past, but often it's been in dramas like Drive and First Man. He plays Ken with a wink and skip in his step, and the freedom makes him very funny. The role even allowed the actor, who tends to keep the media at arm's length, to turn the Barbie press tour into a kind of performance art. "I just decided I was going to kin as hard as I can," he said. "I kinned in the morning, I kinned at night. If I'm honest, I'm kinning a little right now." When he's not actively beaching, Ken primps and pines for Barbie's attention. Gerwig has said that her vision for the character was inspired by Stallone, lest you think the classics have been forgotten. She wasn't talking about Sly's machine guns, but about the other accessories that he and his characters favored. If this doesn't ring a bell, take a moment and Google the phrase Stallone in fur. "When I think of adorned men, I think he's probably the best one," Gerwig has said, "and I feel like Ken was nothing if not a man in search of adornment." There's an entirely different himbo in Yorgos Lanthimos' opulently oddball coming-of-age story, Poor Things. Duncan Wedderburn is a smooth lawyer played by hulking talent Mark Ruffalo. After falling for a captivating undead ingenue named Bella Baxter, Emma Stone, he whisks her away from her sheltered London home for a sexcapade across Europe. When they land on a cruise ship, another man who's competing for her attention writes Duncan off with a sneer. He's a pretty moron, but Duncan has a much higher opinion of himself. Duncan is indeed a superficial, ego-driven Lothario, and he delivers delicious lines with a pretentious, conspicuously unplaceable European accent. "You've just been thrice effed by the very best. It's probable no other man will bring you to the raptures I have." Screenwriter Tony McNamara says he initially wrote the character as a two-dimensional character. He's a cad. Women fall in love with him, he sleeps with them, and then he goes on to someone else, he says. But when Bella, who's grown up without the limitations that society usually puts on a woman, makes clear that she doesn't care all that much about Duncan, Ruffalo really brings the character to life and becomes the funniest part of this off-kilter dramedy. The character works so well, in part, because even when he's frantically trying to hold on to Bella, Duncan is never an evil entity. He doesn't have a malicious bone in his body, says McNamara, adding that the secret to success was casting this cad with probably the nicest human alive in Ruffalo, who's known for playing solid good guys, as in Spotlight and even the Avengers movies. The result is a handsome, horny, ultimately insecure dum-dum. Duncan's job, to put it in terms that Ken would understand, is basically just bed. And Napoleon's job? You would think it'd just be invade. But in Ridley Scott's new movie, Joaquin Phoenix pulls off the most surprising himbo in recent memory. Yes, a biopic about the war genius who conquered most of Europe doesn't seem like the most likely place to find a relatable idiot. But this Napoleon is a dopey mess when it comes to his first wife, Josephine, Vanessa Kirby. Short of stature and big of hat, Napoleon's inability to hold it together in front of his true love makes for some unexpectedly funny moments in an otherwise traditional movie with a lot of cannons. The couple's warm, playful chemistry turns into a lifelong loyalty, even after Napoleon has to divorce Josephine because she can't give him an heir. Jacob Elordi's Saltburn character, Felix, is a more beautiful specimen, if that's what you're into, and the slow burn reveal that his character is a himbo makes him fascinating to behold. Felix is a privileged, popular Oxford student who takes awkward outcast Oliver, Barry Keoghan, under his wing and invites him to his family's lavish country estate. Writer-director Emerald Fennell cast Elordi, a breakout star in Euphoria, when she noticed that in his audition he was examining the fact that Felix was born into privilege and gorgeousness but doesn't exactly have a lot going on under the hood. The thing about someone like Felix is he's incredibly sexy and glamorous and cool, but he is kind of not any of those things either, says Fennell. He's lucky, and he's sort of weak. When some plot twist jeopardizes Felix, we sympathize with him because the lovely dolt was only trying to help a down-and-out classmate, and because Elordi shows us all his vulnerability. He's born with an immense amount of privilege, but he's not born with this swagger and strut. You have to kind of develop that and learn that, Elordi says of Felix. A lot of the time, when you meet people that have that kind of sensibility, it usually comes from a place of great insecurity or misunderstanding of their place in the world. On paper, none of these himbos should be likable. Regardless of where they rank on the vapidity scale, they're often just getting in the way of the main characters. Ken allows his mojo to run amok in his dojo. Duncan becomes increasingly pathetic as he clings to Bella. Napoleon leads his army to a savage victory, but turns into a bumbling, grunting weirdo whenever Josephine enters the frame. And in American fiction, Sterling K. Brown, playing the chiseled surgeon brother to Jeffrey Wright's novelist, shows up when it's most convenient for him, when he wants to have a pool party in his family's summer house, for example, and usually makes more of a mess of things. Yet because of their insecurities, we want to care for these men like we would an injured golden retriever. Unlike their muscle-bound forebears from the 80s, the current generation of himbo characters are rarely malicious, and give or take a French emperor, the power never lies with them. There's an innocence that's endearing, especially to women dealing with toxic masculinity on a day-to-day basis in the real world. There's no real threat with a himbo. They're all beauty and no bite.
Thank you.
Now here's this month's cover story, Forever Simone. The greatest gymnast of all time opens up about life as a newlywed, her recovery from Tokyo, and what's ahead, including Paris. By Leah Fay Cooper. With photographs by Adrienne Raquel, styled by Nicole Chapoteau. Opening photo shows Simone on a leather couch, dressed in white, looking chic and elegant. "Maybe he has a crush on you," Simone Biles says to me, playfully but also seriously. It's a Thursday evening in the Woodlands, a Tony Houston suburb, and the greatest gymnast of all time and I are having dinner at 60 Vines, known for its seasonal cuisine and 60 wines on tap. Biles picked the restaurant. It's one of her favorites, and she comes often. But as a succession of dishes arrives, compliments of the kitchen, seared bass, sliced tri-tip, and later sticky toffee cake and Basque cheesecake delivered by Chef Mikhail Said himself. She notes, this has never happened before. According to Biles, he must be trying to impress me, an unrecognizable writer, and not her, a two-time Olympian and holder of 37 Olympic and World Championship medals, the most in history. "I have a feeling it's not about me," I say, clocking at least three people stealing stares at, definitely her, but we'll go with that. Wearing her sense of humor like a leotard is presumably one of the ways Biles has weathered a life and career marked by record-breaking highs and excruciating lows. After a two-year hiatus following the Tokyo Olympics, Biles returned to competition last August at the U.S. Gymnastics Championships in San Jose, California. There, the 26-year-old won an eighth national title, becoming the oldest woman to clinch the victory and breaking the late Alfred Joachim's seven-title record, which had been in place since 1933. Last fall, at the 2023 Artistic Gymnastics World Championships in Antwerp, Belgium, Biles became the most decorated gymnast in history. Winning gold in the individual all-around, her sixth title, and the most ever for a woman, gold in the balance beam and floor, and silver in the vault. At 26, she also became the oldest U.S. woman athlete ever to win those medals. "I felt like I was back in my element, and it was exciting," she says. "But I was truly petrified. I had the training to back it up because we worked really hard, but I wasn't as confident or as comfortable as I wanted to be." Whatever impact the nerves had on Biles, they didn't deter her from landing a Yurchenko double pike vault, a first for a woman in international competition. The move, which consists of a round off onto a springboard, a back handspring onto a vault, and two flips in the pike position, has since been renamed the Biles 2, bringing the total of stunts coined after the 4'8" phenom to 5. "It was kind of surprising," Biles says of her success back on the circuit, her modesty genuine, just taking the risk of allowing myself to be vulnerable in front of a crowd, competing again was a win for me. Antwerp also offered a refreshing mix of nostalgia and normalcy. Biles competed in her first world championships there 10 years ago, but didn't get to explore the city like she did this time around. She went to a cafe for an authentic Belgian waffle, which was amazing, she says, and explored the architecture and shops in Antwerp's Old Town neighborhood. Like so many of the places Biles' career has taken her, Antwerp is literally and figuratively worlds away from where she came from. Born in Columbus, Ohio, to a mother who struggled to care for her children as she battled addiction, Biles spent her early years in and out of foster care. At 5, Biles and her younger sister, Adria, were formally adopted by their maternal grandfather, Ron, and his wife, Nellie, whom she calls her parents, who raised the girls alongside their two boys in Spring, Texas, the Houston suburb Biles still calls home. Her two older siblings, Ashley and Tevin, were adopted by Ron's sister, Harriet. When Biles was six, Ron and Nellie enrolled her and Adria in gymnastics classes. "Honestly, for gymnastics, that's kind of late," Biles says. "Most people start in mommy and me classes as soon as they can walk. I truly was gifted, but I had to work for everything that I've had because of that delay." Her parents had to work toward her success, too. Gymnastics is very expensive, and we're so blessed that our parents could afford for us to do it, she says, adding that it's the only sport she and her sister ever pursued. Biles says she never worried about finances, but she's still not sure if that's because her parents didn't have that concern or merely shielded her from any hardship. She is, however, keenly aware of the sacrifices her entire family has made on her behalf, their time, their effort, and their money. "I just wanted to try to do college gymnastics," Biles says, "but everything changed after she watched Gabby Douglas, Michaela Maroney, Allie Raisman, Kyla Ross, and Jordan Weber dominate at the 2012 Olympics in London. I saw those girls, and I was like, I'm going to the same camps they're going to. Maybe I could do that." In 2013, when Biles was 16, she won her first all-around world championship title, becoming the first African-American gymnast to do so. 3 years later, she stunned the world with her performance during the Summer Olympics in Rio, where she won 4 gold medals, an American record for women's gymnastics at a single games, plus a bronze. The rise to fame that accompanied her feat was exciting, intense, and a bit disorienting. "It still is all of those things," Biles says. "I think everyone wants to be famous, and then when it happens, you almost hit a wall, and you have an identity crisis. You're like, am I made out for this? Why did I wish for this?" While the adjustment was challenging for Biles, it was especially difficult for her parents. They've always wanted to protect their daughter from invasive fans, reporters, and photographers, but everything is kind of out of their hands, she says. "I'm not saying that people scream and line up like I'm Taylor Swift, but I still get a lot of attention. When 5 people come up to me and they're pushing for a photo, I just get a little flustered. My anxiety kicks in." Nothing, then, could have prepared Biles for the aftermath of Tokyo in 2021. The games kicked off that July under unprecedented circumstances and after a year-long postponement. Athletes were largely relegated to their rooms and competition venues, and there were no spectators. Biles helped her team qualify for the all-around final, and was the only athlete to qualify for the finals in all 4 individual events. But something was amiss. On a vault, she completed just 1.5 of an attempted 2.5 twist and nearly fell when she landed. Afterward, she withdrew from the team competition, citing mental health concerns and a word that would become household famous, the twisties, a disconnect between the mind and the body that causes a gymnast to lose track of motion through space. Though the average person watching from home probably chalked it up to nerves, I knew right then and there something was wrong, says Biles' best friend, Rachel Retker, from her home in Spring. The two met as 6-year-olds in gymnastics class. The look Retker noticed on her friend's face wasn't nervousness, it was worry. "I texted her, 'Hey, what is going on? Are you okay? I thought she was hurt, because there's no way she should have landed like that.' She texted me like, 'I'm not hurt, but I'm just going through some things.'" One by one, Biles began withdrawing from other competitions. The individual all-around, the vault, the uneven bars, the floor. She competed in the balance beam, winning the bronze medal. Team USA, which included Jordan Chiles, Sunisa Lee, and Grace McCallum, finished 2nd, behind Russia. The criticism was scathing and relentless. And though many came to Biles' defense, "Of course you have all the assholes that are like, you're a quitter," she says, and they just ran with that. Biles was tempted to go off on those deriding her, but ultimately decided that the only worthy fight was the one for her own well-being. predictably as pundits and trolls declared that the Olympian had selfishly let her country down, others tried to put me on this pedestal as a mental health advocate, she says. I was not okay with that. If I can be a lending hand and help people, then I'll be open, honest, and vulnerable, she continues. But you cannot stick me in front of a crowd and say, do everything she's doing. Biles had a major source of support in her then-boyfriend Jonathan Owens, an NFL safety who at the time was playing for the Houston Texans. The pair had met in 2020 on an invitation-only dating app. I had just broken up with someone, and my friend was like, get on Rhea, get on Rhea. Biles tells me as our spread continues expanding into burrata, Caesar salad, and Brussels sprouts. My guard went straight up when she said dating site, Biles says, but she matched with Owens the first week she was on the app. The second week I met him in person, she says, and the rest is history. We were hooked. Owens' recollection is similar, with one added detail. She doesn't like to admit it, but she messaged me first, he tells me over the phone. Because their relationship started at the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, most of their early dates consisted of watching movies, playing games, and drinking sangria at each other's houses during quarantine. I just noticed her laugh, Owens says of those initial interactions. It was just contagious. We could talk all day, and we'd stayed up late, and there just wasn't an awkward moment. Owens knew immediately that he liked Biles, but I ask, did he know he was falling for the greatest gymnast of all time? A lot of people don't believe me when I say I had no clue, he insists. During the 2016 Olympics in Rio, Owens was at training camp at his alma mater, Missouri Western State University. He caught some basketball and a bit of track, but I never once was like, oh, let me check gymnastics out. Things clicked when he found Biles on Instagram. I was like, man, she got a lot of followers. She must be pretty good. We got close really quickly, Raisman says, of her time training with Biles before the 2016 Games. We have very different personalities. When I was training, I was a lot more of a perfectionist, she continues, speaking on a call from her home in Boston. Simone is definitely more laid back than I am. That balance was really good for me. She was always making me laugh. Biles was always raising the competitive bar for the team, too. We always used to joke, second place was first place because it was too hard to beat her, Raisman says. Their bond strengthened under devastating circumstances. Both are among more than 200 women who came forward with sexual abuse allegations against former USA Gymnastics Dr. Larry Nassar. He was ultimately convicted of various crimes and will spend the rest of his life in prison. I'm very grateful for the support and how much our voices were heard, Raisman says, but it felt like an open wound that wouldn't heal. So to have Simone, who understood what I was going through, we could talk about it, and we could relate when I felt like I couldn't relate to most people. It was really nice. It still is very nice to have that. Coming forward with their experiences not only shocked the world, but it shocked those closest to the gymnast, too. It was really heartbreaking to hear her side of the story and hear what happened, Rettger says. I had no idea. I had no idea at all. Biles doesn't address the abuse directly, but in discussing why she's been so outspoken against USA Gymnastics and the organization's failure to protect athletes in the past, she asserts that she's been through hell and back. She could have dealt with that trauma privately, she says, but knowing that people listen when she speaks, a realization that she says took her a while to come to helps her. I wish everybody could have the outlets and the platforms and the confidence to speak out, she says, but she knows that's not the case. Sometimes I'm speaking not only for myself, but I'm being a voice for others that can't. Biles believes that USA Gymnastics has been moving in a positive direction. When something like that happens, it obviously turns everything completely upside down, she says. And then they make some of the rules so strict that it almost makes it hard for anybody to do their job. But I think their intentions are there. Last year, Raisman tuned in with pride to watch her friend and former teammate compete in Antwerp. For her to come back now, she says of Biles' post-Tokyo return, it really feels like she's doing it for herself, and she's doing it on her own terms. Over the course of our call, Raisman repeatedly points out that Biles makes everything look so easy. It's an accurate observation of her stunts and of her foray back into gymnastics, but neither are easy. I wish I could sit here and tell you it was glorious, Biles says of her time off following Tokyo. When I took a break after 2016, I had the time of my life. I was doing anything and everything. But after 2020, it was kind of depressing until I started therapy and got help. I felt like a failure. Even though I was empowering so many people and speaking out about mental health, every time I talked about my experience in Tokyo, because it obviously didn't go the way that I had planned, it stung a little bit. But all in all, it was the best decision. Biles remains a vocal proponent of mental health care. I've always been in therapy, and I've always been an advocate for medicine, she says, adding that her mother, Nellie, is a nurse, and medication has never been stigmatized in her family. If you need an inhaler, take it. If you have anxiety, take it. I'm no stranger to medicine. Years ago, Biles was prescribed Lexapro for anxiety, and she continues to take the medication today. When Biles resumed training in late 2022, the gymnastics was largely mental. She tried convincing herself that she was cured from the twisties, that she wasn't scared to jump and flip and catapult herself into the air. Well, that was a lie, she says. I was petrified. Biles eased her way back into a training routine, spending a few gym sessions just jumping on the trampoline, gradually working her way toward one full workout a day. By January 2023, she was back to the training schedule she currently maintains 4 days a week, up at 6:20 a.m. and out the door by 6:45 for 7 a.m. practice, home at 10:30, then lunch. She tends to her three bulldogs, Lilo, Rambo, and Zeus, then naps for an hour to an hour and a half, then back at the gym from 2 to 5 p.m., Thursdays and Saturdays are half days, Sunday is off. Biles is enjoying the regimen more than she anticipated. I owe that to my teammates, she says, adding that most of them are much younger. I didn't think I'd be having fun like this at my age in the gym, but they keep it fun. They've been bigger rocks to me than they know. One of those teammates is UCLA standout Childs, who trains in Texas during the collegiate off-season. Seeing her do all of her skills that are named after her, Childs says, I'm just in awe. The two met about a decade ago at a national team camp. Giddy over the opportunity to interact with Biles, the current NCAA floor exercise and uneven bars champion remembers thinking to herself, this girl's going to be my friend one day. That premonition proved true. Biles helped the Oregon native make arrangements to train in Texas prior to Tokyo, and when Biles and Owens wed in Cabo last May, Childs was among their 144 guests. If I'm going to be honest, obviously he's very fine, Biles says of her initial attraction to Owens, but besides his looks, he was so sweet and kind, and I think what I liked about him was his confidence. He truly believes he's the best at everything, she says, clearly amused. Owens proposed on Valentine's Day, 2022, and last April, the couple had a small civil ceremony in Houston, followed by a May celebration in Mexico. Over the course of that weekend, Biles wore four dresses by Galia Lahav. We could have had so many more people, Biles says, but we really wanted to make it as intimate and as special as possible. She and Owens deftly curated their guest list. I was like, not to knock your football coach from third grade, but baby, when was the last time you talked to him? Their vision was realized. I've never had so much fun in my life, Biles says. I was 19 when I won my first Olympics, and I was like, how am I supposed to top this? My wedding topped it. It was the greatest feeling ever. After the wedding, Owens flew to Green Bay to officially join the Packers. I cried a lot, Bile said, adding that while she knows they can handle the distance, she wishes she could spend more time with her husband. We're both so busy, so it's not like I'm sitting around waiting for him to come home, but it's just hard. Still, we love being with the Packers organization and Lambeau, she says, naming Green Bay's legendary stadium. The fans are, I wouldn't even call them crazy, they're dedicated. They love their players as if those are their children. When Biles got back in the gym, she was sure that she wanted to go after a spot on the 2024 Olympic team. Her training and competition schedule suggests that's still the case. During an October 2023 episode of Today, when Hoda Kotb asked if wagering $100 on Biles' return was a safe bet, the gymnast told her, "I think you'd be pretty lucky." She's much more coy about the decision over dinner, though. "If I don't make it to Paris, it won't absolutely crush me," she says. "So nothing definitive?" "Correct," she says. Sport has shaped Biles' life, but many other things fill it. She adores spending time with her one-year-old niece, Ronnie, and evenings drinking wine over FaceTime with her mother-in-law. The newlyweds are building a home in spring and have a place in Green Bay, where she's become a box seat and sideline regular. Biles' reaction when Owens recovered a fumble for a touchdown during the Thanksgiving Day game against the Detroit Lions, an exclamation point heavy message on X, formerly Twitter, "That's my husband," 4 exclamation points, my mans. The following week, when the Packers played the Kansas City Chiefs, Biles arrived at Lambeau to a frenzy over both her and Taylor Swift, who was there to support her boyfriend, Chiefs tight end Travis Kelce. "It's a little bit weird, because I'm like, this is definitely not my gig," she says, of seeing posters with her face on them. "But I know how excited the fans are." Though a Biles Swift photo op would have definitely gone viral, there was no selfie, Biles says. She and Swift were sitting in different sections, and I'm not sure they were exactly happy that the Packers were beating them. Currently, Biles is especially passionate about the work she's doing with Friends of the Children, a nonprofit that pairs kids in foster care with long-term mentors. "I'll always advocate for foster kids," she says. "I was a foster kid, and something very out of the ordinary happened to me." While Biles knows she's an anomaly, she's hopeful that with enough support, more kids in foster care will graduate from high school, attend college, and go on to live full, successful lives. "We're opening a chapter in Houston," she says, of the organization. "I think the kids deserve that." As Biles and I move on from the Brussels sprouts to the desserts, she tells me that she's taking her friends out the following night. "I'm doing a little party bus," she says, sharing that they'll be headed to Ciel, a restaurant and lounge in central Houston, featuring Vegas-like entertainment. "I'm so excited," she says, and understandably so. For every skill Biles mastered and medal she won, there was a birthday party she didn't go to or a school dance she skipped. "I used to be really sad about it," she says, of all the moments she missed out on, "but they come back to you." For the past 2 hours, Biles's confidence has radiated across the dinner table. "That self-assuredness took a while to grow into," she says. "It's palpable, but so is the faith and humility that keeps her grounded. I never thought I'd be who I am," she says. "But look at God's blessings." This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.